Chapter 5. Hey, Joe. Skippy's muffled voice came from inside my jacket. Just a minute, I shouted toward the pocket, trying to finish eating the muffin. Damn it, I had asked Skippy to leave me in peace that morning. In disgust, I tossed the half-eaten muffin into the lake, which prompted a big fish to immediately hit it. Crap, that was my last muffin. I should have saved one to use as bait. With the phone to my ear, I answered the pain-in-the-ass beer can. What's up? Well, I... Hey, are you fishing in the rain? Yeah, so? Don't normal people wait for a nice day to go fishing? It's peaceful out here, I like it. What is so important? Oh, nothing much. Pretty quiet up here. I'm chilling in my new man cave since the duty officer ejected my old escape pod and blew it to dust with a maser cannon. Captain Reed has a gun to her head. Captain Poole is alone against a 7-man Delta Force team that is trying to seize control of the ship. You know, a typical Tuesday. Holy shit, it was actually Sunday. What the f- This will go faster if I just give you a sit rep instead of the usual blah 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 of you interrupting me with stupid questions. Deal. Great. Okay, the UN Secretary Council has scheduled a vote this evening on whether to send the Dutchman out to surrender to the Giraptha. The measure is expected to pass because most governments are scared shitless about Max Holt's warships coming here. I knew about that vote, and I was going to tell you, even though you asked me to leave you alone, because little Joey wants to catch a fish this big so his mommy can cook it, and... I need a break, Skippy. Was that you not interrupting me? Was that you giving a sit-rep, or you whining about me wanting 10 freaking minutes to myself for a change? Fine, he huffed. Anywho, what I did not know was the five nations of UNEF met in secret this morning and already voted for surrendering to the Giraptha. How could you not know? You know everything. First, Mr. Jackass, they apparently conducted all communications face-to-face or by writing notes on paper. Can you imagine that? So primitive. But, effective. The site where they held the vote had no electronics at all, nothing I could hack into. Well, not quite. I could have hacked in if I knew about the meeting or cared about what a bunch of monkeys in suits were doing. Monkeys wearing suits. That's funny. You know what is even more funny? Monkeys wearing tuxedos while riding bicycles. Oh, even better, riding tiny tricycles. Yeah, that's freaking hilarious. How do you know about it now? Count Chocula told me. He is being held by the French intelligence service in an underground interrogation cell, also with no electronics. Fortunately, that cell has a single bare light bulb hanging from the ceiling, and I have been paying close attention to old Hansi. Because you're concerned about him? I didn't know you cared. More like because I was hoping he would do something stupid to amuse me, but let's go with the care and concern thing, if that makes me look better. To make a long story short, Chotek is clever enough to suspect I could listen to him through that light bulb. Admittedly, the audio quality is poor, that building is old, and the wiring dates back way before World War II. I kind of amazed myself, really. To listen in to Chocula, I had to create a map of all electrical activity in the building, then calibrate... Can we agree you are amazingly awesome and skip the part where you brag about yourself? What did Chotek say? You say you know the extent of my awesomeness, but when I... Sit rep, short and to the point. Fine, jackass, he muttered under his breath. Chotek warned me about a plan to seize the Dutchman. They didn't trust you and the pirates. They also did not trust me, which is totally understandable. What is the situation upstairs? Damn it, there's a Delta team taking control of the ship? Poole is handling it. Well, she's trying to. Nothing you can do about it right now. What you need to be concerned about is yourself. The FBI team at your house was ordered to take you into custody about 6 minutes ago. They stormed into the house and scared the crap out of your mother. She whomped one of them in the face with a cast-iron skillet, laid him out cold on the kitchen floor. I like your mom. Crap. I picked up the paddle and began digging into the water for shore where I had parked Tom's old Jeep. Are my folks okay? There was a standoff between three feds and your father holding a baseball bat, but when the feds saw you weren't in the house, they bailed. They called for air support and have sealed off roads around your neighborhood. We live in the woods, Skippy. There is no neighborhood. You know what I mean. The feds have three helos in the air now, but don't worry. I've got them chasing a ghost along Route 212 near Merrill. You are not the only pirate in jeopardy. Orders have gone out to secure the entire crew. Shit. It's lucky that I snuck out to go fishing. True, as you monkeys misunderstand the concept of luck. Hey, I stopped paddling as a thought hit me. The feds are looking for me? Why hasn't the army called me and just ordered me to surrender? Would you want to know about such a call? Shit. No. Then as far as you know, the authorities have not tried to contact you. You can't refuse to obey an order you never received, right? That was skating on very thin ice, but I wasn't going to argue about it. Hypothetically, if the army did call me, what would the order have been? Well, they wanted you to... Hypothetically, Skippy. Oh, yeah, of course. I can tell you that army leadership does not agree with the decision to contact the Jurapta. The other services also argued against surrendering, but they are subordinate to civilian authority in your country. In other countries, the militaries generally think contacting the Jurapta is premature without knowing when the Maxalts are expected to be here, and without first making at least some sort of effort to stop those Maxalt ships. The United States Army is in a particularly bad position because an army officer whose name rhymes with Schmo Dipshit got you monkeys into this mess. Schmo Dipshit? That was a good one. Even I had to chuckle. All right, close enough. I looked at my Z-phone. There were no missed calls, no text messages, no emails. No evidence anyone tried to contact me. My other cell phone, the one provided to me by the feds so they could track me, was under my bed back home. Joe, what matters now is I have a dropship coming to pick you up. You may have to apologize later. We don't have time to be gentle about this, so I will have the Falcon coming in at Mach 7, and that sonic boom is going to wake up people all over the state. ETA is just over 12 minutes. Okay, okay. Please contact Tom and tell him where I parked his Jeep. The keys are under the passenger seat. I am such a dope. Who cares about an old Jeep in such a crisis? How many other pirates can you pick up before the authorities get to them? Working on it. Lieutenant Colonel Jennifer Sims was soundly asleep when her regular cell phone blared her awake. It was Skippy, and it was an emergency. The FBI was coming for her. She had 7 minutes to decide what to do before the black SUVs rolled up in front of her apartment. Without hesitation, she reached under the bed for her go-bag, pulled on the clothes and shoes she wore the previous day, slipped out the sliding glass door, and ran across a field into the wooded area. By the time she reached the elementary school, the low clouds behind her were flashing blue from the FBI's lights. Am I okay, Skippy? Uh-huh. I jacked your car, and I'm driving it like a maniac toward the interstate. The FBI just heard about it. Oops, just clipped another car. Sorry about your headlight. And the fender. That made her slow her pace. Skippy, I don't have a self-driving car. Duh, that thing handles like a refrigerator on a skateboard. Seriously, what were you thinking when you bought that shitbox? Crap, I just took out someone's mailbox. That's a federal offense, right? Maybe I can plea bargain down to the death penalty. The car was cheap, she answered defensively. I've not needed to drive a lot for the last couple years, you know. True, you did crash that truck in Nigeria, so everyone is safer that you are not. Where should I go? What's the plan? Let me think. Stay where you are. Here? She looked around her in the pre-dawn darkness. I'm in the middle of an elementary school baseball outfield.
Yep, perfect place to land the Falcon I have dropping down for you. It will be there in 5 minutes. Lucky for you, I was flight testing that Falcon after replacing an engine, so it was already over Montana. Texas isn't that far.
Montana to Texas isn't far?
Not at Mach 25, it isn't. Better cover your ears when it gets here.
Sims knew better than to argue with the beer can. She used the time to duck into the porta-potty near the bleachers and trying to drag her fingers through the tangled mess of her hair. Then she waited, hands over her ears, until she saw a problem.
Skippy, there's a cell phone tower to the south of the school and a power line behind the ball field. Will those be a problem for the Falcon?
Even a Falcon, the smaller of the two types of Theranan dropship, was a big damn thing. The power line is a problem. Taking care of that now. I will need you to press the big red button on your phone to authorize weapons. I still have that annoying restriction in my programming. Oh, hey, best not to look in that direction, huh?
Oh, shit.
She swept to the second set of icons on her phone, and there it was, a big red button app that hadn't been there the previous night.
Even facing in the other direction with her eyes closed, she saw the bright explosions as the Falcon's Mazer ripped into the base of the powerline towers, and they fell, sending searing bright arcs of light. When she turned around to see the incoming dropship firing its nose thrusters to slow down, its belly was illuminated by sparks coming from the downed power line. The city behind the dropship was going dark from the power outage. "Was that really necessary?" she shouted over the whining turbines of the Falcon as it settled down in the outfield, its heavy skids plowing deep into the damp soil.
"There's a high school football field a half mile away. I could have run there."
"Was it strictly necessary? Maybe not. Was it awesome? Absolutely."
"Why do men love blowing things up?" Jennifer clutched her go bag with both hands and ran up the Falcon's ramp, using her knees to brace herself in a jump seat because the ship was already taking off.
"It's a dumbass thing," Skippy admitted. "You wouldn't understand. Hang on. We have a stop to make before climbing for orbit."
Skippy was not kidding about the sonic boom. The dropship came straight over the water toward me, spun around so the open back ramp splashed in the shallow water, and I waded out to slog my wet boots up the ramp. If I wasn't wet before, I was then, as the belly jets kicked up a nearly blinding spray of water. When I was halfway up the ramp, there was a long, low rumble that sounded like never-ending thunder. Anyone in the North Woods who decided to sleep in on that rainy Sunday morning would be woken up by that alarming sound. To save time, I took a jump seat at the top of the ramp.
"Go, Skip!"
My order was cut off by the Falcon standing on its tail and leaping up for the sky. "Crap," I thought. "I hope the jet wash doesn't knock over Tom's Jeep. Or worse, knock down a tree to crush it. If a Jeep rolls on its side, you can just push it back onto its wheels."
"Where are we going, Skippy?" I asked as the ship began to level out and punch through the sound barrier.
I knew we went supersonic because the sound of the engine exhaust was muted. Those sound waves couldn't catch up to the ship. While we talked, I unstrapped and labored to walk toward the cockpit, holding on to seatbacks along the way.
"To pick up Smythe and hopefully some other pirates, we have to go suborbital to get to the UK quickly, so hang on. I'm pushing your Falcon hard."
"Yeah, I can feel that," I grunted as I rolled into a pilot couch and the straps automatically hugged me tightly. Without a flight suit, I was feeling naked and uncomfortable. The flight suits compensated for the pilot couches having been designed for Theranin, and even modified, were too small for me.
"How many pirates can we count on?"
"Depressingly few, Joe. Sims is aboard another Falcon. She..."
"Sims?
She told me she wouldn't sign up for another mission."
"Well, that may have been before she was told she couldn't go. Jennifer is a remarkably stubborn woman. The best way to get her to do something is to tell her she can't. Don't tell her I said that. Besides, she is pissed off about your government being stupid."
"Well, hell, I'm sure glad to have her with us. Who else?"
"Of the original merry band of pirates who left Paradise, only you and Sims. Giraud is being held by French authorities. The French have proven to be quite efficient at securing the entire team. We won't get anyone from them. Desai is aboard a military aircraft over the Indian Ocean. We have no way to get to her. Chang is at a Chinese military base, and we would be risking a firefight to get him. I have not been able to contact him at all. Adams is surrounded by Marines at Quantico. I'm doing what I can to contact her, but she is on lockdown. Basically, Joe, the best we can hope for is maybe a half dozen people off the surface. Everyone else has been secured. This operation, the ground side part of it, was well planned."
I briefly considered contacting special ops people who had not been aboard the Dutchman, but might be willing to sign up now. No, that was a stupid idea that I discarded immediately. Not only would I not know the new people, I would be asking them to violate a direct order and throw their careers away on a snap decision. What worried me was some new people might go aboard to infiltrate the crew and take over the ship. That was not practical. I could not imagine myself randomly calling a ranger or SEAL unit and asking if anyone there felt like committing mutiny that day.
"Okay, we'll make this up as we go."
"Standard operating procedure, you mean?"
"Yeah, damn it. Could we count on anyone aboard the ship other than Poole and Reed?"
"The two CIC officers up here who blew up my escape pod are off the list, Joe. I don't care if they have a change of heart."
"Agreed."
To be entrusted with responsibility for taking Skippy out of the fight, those two officers must be hardcore committed to the operation.
"No one else?"
"A few people here and there. Joe, the problem is the UNEF nations were prepared for this. We should have acted before the governments assigned security teams to watch all the pirates. Back then, we didn't need to act. Hey, wait. I remembered a news report I saw a couple days ago. The Chinese and French dropships are really down for maintenance? That wasn't a fake news report to make us think they only have two birds available? The report was accurate, Joe. I even reviewed their maintenance plan for them last week. Earth governments control only 4 dragons, and their supply of replacement parts is thin to the point of becoming dangerous. Okay, then the other dragon controlled by the U.S. is up at the Yukishan? Near the Kishan, yes. It is conducting a training exercise now. The purpose of that flight is to bring technicians up to the Kishan to work on getting the reactor restarted. I am helping them with that. Training, huh? Who's aboard that dragon? A roster popped up on the console in front of me. That's quite an international crew for an American dropship. An American crew flew the dragon up to the Kishan. Now an international team is using it for training. The stated purpose of the current flight is to simulate a boarding operation. Yeah, that makes sense. Can you fake orders to get that dragon over to the Dutchman and block any real orders coming from Earth or from the Kishan? Doing that now? And done. I have control of the dragon's comm system. They will only hear messages I send. Transmitting orders now. Joe, I have a question. You intend to bring those people aboard the Dutchman under false pretenses. Is that not considered dishonorable? Once they are aboard the ship, we can tell them the truth and they can decide whether to sign on. We need people, Skippy. I need to give Smythe options for assembling a team. We do need soldiers, Joe. Doing the best I can. Starting descent now, he said as I felt the nose drop slightly. Although I was in the cockpit and strapped into the pilot seat, I did not take over the controls, as I didn't have good situational awareness yet and had to trust Skippy to fly me to wherever he planned to pick up Smythe. Crap. If Smythe could make the rendezvous. Does Smythe have a security team with him? Not anymore. It's a long story, Joe. Shut up and hang on. When the call from Skippy made his Z-phone buzz, Lieutenant Colonel Jeremy Ewan Smythe was up to his chest in icy cold water, fording a stream in the rugged Scottish Highlands. He was not plunging himself into frigid water as part of an assigned and therefore mandatory military exercise. He had volunteered for an adventure race, because of course that is what Jeremy Smythe liked to do during his leisure time. He also enjoyed scuba diving, skydiving, hang gliding, and plenty of other activities Joe Bishop would describe as falling into the category of crazy shit. The current activity was a 100-kilometer foot race for teams of 4 over trails and barely visible tracks that could not truly be described as trails. Part of the race required sticking to the defined trail. Other sections allowed teams to strike out away from the trail to cut straight across the countryside if they thought they could save time. To make matters more complicated, the teams had to contact checkpoints along the way, and the only navigation gear they could bring was a compass and a map provided by the race organizers. Because the map was handed out less than 10 minutes before the race started, the teams did not have much time to identify the required checkpoints and plan a route before the starting gun fired. To make the experience even more jolly, there was a chilly rainstorm blowing in from the Faroe Islands and visibility at times was less than a quarter mile. Jeremy Smythe was exhausted and hungry. His soaked shirt was chafing his neck, and he had tweaked an ankle stumbling on a hidden rock while fording a stream. He had not been so happy since he left the surface of Gingerbread. The phone kept buzzing as he slogged through the water and onto the muddy bank, last of the 4-man team. Technically, the 4-person team included one woman, who jogged slowly with a look of mild annoyance as she waited for her 3 male companions to catch up.
"One moment," Smythe gasped, hearing his waterlogged shoes squish on the muddy trail.
He kept running while he extracted the Z-phone from a pouch on the side of his water pack.
"You brought a phone?" His teammate Katie Frey wagged a finger accusingly. "That's against the rules. You'll get us DQ'd."
She was not alone in looking at Smythe with dismay. None of the team wanted to risk being disqualified after running for 4 grueling hours in bad weather. Besides, they were in 3rd place.
"This is a special phone."
He waved the credit card thin alien device that Skippy had somehow smuggled to him.
"It must be an emergency," Smythe lied,
for he feared a certain dodgy beer can may have simply become bored and wanted someone to talk to. If Skippy wanted to sing show tunes, Smythe planned to tuck the phone under a rock and keep going.
"Hello? That is what you do for fun?"
Smythe gritted his teeth. I'm busy. He was about to fling the alien phone away when a shout stopped him.
Sorry, we have a major problem.
That made Smythe slow down, waving for his teammates to continue. Instead, they also slowed to keep pace slightly ahead of him.
What?
The UN has decided to surrender to the Jarraptha before the Maxalts get here in the hope that the Rindaloo Coalition will protect Earth.
Bollocks!
Smythe stopped running, stunned.
We'll be caught in the bloody crossfire.
Exactly. What matters to you right now is UNEF Command is trying to seize the Flying Dutchman, so Joe is pulling together whoever he can to take the ship out ASAP and kill those two Maxalt ships before they reach Earth.
Bloody hell.
The shocked look on Smythe's face made his companions halt on the trail, and he held up a finger for silence.
Bloody hell indeed.
A Delta Force team is aboard the ship, and Captain Poole is attempting to deal with those cheeky buggers. Joe needs to know. Are you in? There is a dropship on the way to pick you up. It is only fair to warn you the crew roster will be very thin. Most of the pirates are on lockdown. The RAF has a pair of helicopters coming to take you into custody. Don't worry. I scrambled their avionics gear. They will have to land soon, well away from you. So, Colonel Smythe, are you in?
You're damned right I'm in, Smythe declared.
You're sure? Joe mumbled some blah-blah-blah about disobeying orders or other meaningless shit like that.
I have not received any orders, he insisted, lowering his voice to avoid being overheard.
It didn't work. One of the team was a fellow member of 22 Special Air Services Regiment, a man named Jason Nunnally, who Smythe had never served with, but who had been eager to join the race team on short notice. On hearing the team leader say the word orders, Nunnally acted instantly. Jason Nunnally was fast. Katie Frey was faster. If the man had been casual about unzipping his waist pack and reaching in, she might have assumed he was getting an energy bar to eat. Instead, he made an abrupt motion that set off alarms in her brain, and she reacted without waiting for her decision-making capability to catch up. Trusting her instincts in hazardous situations was an ingrained habit from her training. As Nunnally pulled out the pistol and lifted it to point at Smythe, she chopped his weapon-holding arm aside with a blow to the elbow, while her other hand delivered a vicious kidney punch and slammed into the man from behind for both of them to sprawl in the mud. Nunnally grunted from pain and rolled to one side to throw her off. A kidney punch would disable most men. Even a tough SAS soldier was not fully capable after such a painful injury. The two wrestled, rolling over in the sodden grass and heath until Nunnally got a hand free and around her throat. He froze when he felt the cold steel of his own pistol pressed hard against his temple.
You might want to think twice about that, Smythe advised in a calm manner.
Seeing the futility of resisting, Nunnally slumped to the ground, his teeth grinding as waves of pain radiated from his lower back.
Colonel,
Frey rose warily to her feet, not taking time or energy to wipe the clumps of matted grass and mud from her face.
What the hell is going on, if you don't mind? I'm sorry.
Nunnally rocked back and forth on the ground, the pain now overwhelming.
Oh, I'm sorry, Frey retorted. You'll be peeing blood for a week.
Orders, Nunnally ignored her, focusing his attention on Smythe.
It was orders, you understand?
Colonel, he grimaced.
What the bloody hell is going on?
My orders didn't explain why the army wants you detained.
I understand.
Smythe dropped beside the injured man, holding the spout of his water pack to the man's lips.
Drink this, Nunnally. Staff Sergeant Grudzian, Lieutenant Frey.
He looked up to his teammates.
The United Nations has decided to surrender us to the Jarraptha.
The Jarraptha? Frey asked, astonished. Patrons of the Ruhar?
They're our enemy.
Smythe shook his head.
Everyone up there is our enemy, but the real enemy at the moment are the Kristang and Theranin.
You came here aboard a Theranin ship. Frey took a half-step backward. Had she made a mistake by not picking up the pistol?
A Theranin ship that we captured, then we killed the entire crew. Lieutenant, the truth is a bloody long tale. Don't believe UNEF's cover story. Surely you have heard rumors.
Silently, she nodded, and Grudzian joined her. They had both heard rumors, and the official story from UNEF Command had not made much sense. Smythe stood up and discarded his water pack, dropping it gently onto Nunnally's chest.
I don't have much time.
He looked to the gray sky. How close was the dropship? In the gusty wind, you would likely not hear it approach until it was within a couple kilometers. UNEF Command is attempting to seize control of the Flying Dutchman, and Colonel Bishop plans to take the ship out to—
Excuse me, sir.
Justin Grudzian waved a hand, speaking carefully to be understood in his Polish accent.
Colonel Bishop? The only bishop I know in your crew is a sergeant.
Bishop got a field promotion direct to colonel when he was on Paradise.
I know. He nodded at three shocked faces.
New war, new reality, new rules, he explained. Bishop is captain of the ship. He was in command of the raid back when they captured the ship from the Theranin. Don't let his youth and media image fool you. He is a bloody brilliant commander. The best I have ever served with. There were a pair of Maxalt's warships coming to Earth. I know this is a lot to process. Bishop is taking the ship out to stop the Maxalt's, and I'm joining him. Apparently, he looked with pity at Nunnally. Someone has a different idea what we should be doing.
My orders,
Nunnally grunted in pain.
We're only to hold you until the RAF arrives. They didn't tell me why. I might have told them to go to hell if they told me the truth.
The Royal Air Force will not be joining us as scheduled.
Smythe allowed a smile to flash across his face. A dropship, he pointed to the low clouds, is on its way to bring me to the Dutchman. Then we are going out to kick in the teeth of the Maxalt's.
What about us?
Grudzian asked, cocking his head to listen for approaching airspace craft.
Your best option would be to stay here with Nunnally. I'll call in your position once I'm in orbit. The RAF can pick you up.
What are our other options?
Frey scraped mud away from her face and ran fingers through her matted ponytail.
You?
Smythe shrugged.
You have no other options.
His hand tensed around the pistol he held, muzzle pointed at the ground away from his feet. He had carefully judged the distance between himself, Frey, and Grudzian. They were far enough away for him to be safe. For their safety, too. They both knew they had no chance to try anything rash.
What if we want to join you?
Frey glanced at Grudzian. Justin Grudzian held up his hands.
My wife just had a baby 4 months ago. I can't deploy now. Not off-world.
I'm not married,
Katie stated, for the first time grateful her last relationship had broken up 3 months prior.
Can I go with you?
Smythe suppressed a groan. Too many people in the special operations community around the globe wanted to join the merry band of pirates without full and careful consideration for the sacrifices involved. The last thing the ship needed was a star-struck amateur. Except Katie Frey was not an amateur. She was a lieutenant with the Canadian Joint Task Force 2 in Britain for joint training exercises with the SAS. Smythe had not intended to create an international team for the race. It had worked out that way when he contacted people to assemble a team. Sergeant Justin Grudzian served with the Polish Army Grupa Reagowania Operacyjno Manowrowego, or GROM, anti-terrorist unit, also in Britain as part of the joint training exercise. When the exercises had ended 3 days ago, Frey and Grudzian had been the first to agree enthusiastically when Smythe proposed to put together a team for the adventure race.
Listen, Staff Sergeant, think carefully.
He thought his ears detected the whine of a dropship's turbines.
This would be certain suicide for your careers. You need to—
What if you fail up there?
Katie pointed to the sky. No one had ever accused her of being shy.
If those Maxalt ships get here—
Everyone on Earth dies,
Smythe explained.
Maybe a few lucky ones will become slaves for a while.
Is surrendering to the Jarraptha any better?
No,
Smythe shook his head emphatically.
It is not.
Grudzian shot Frey a warning glance, fearing she was caught up in the moment.
Colonel, then why is UNEF planning to contact these Jarraptha?
Because the bloody politicians have their heads up their arses, Smythe spat. They haven't been out there. We have no allies in the galaxy, and the Jarraptha won't help us. Even if they wanted to, they can't. The war up there is too big and been going on for too long. No one is going to risk their own security to help our little planet.
I am going with you.
Frey looked up rather than at Smythe. They all heard an aircraft approaching, and it was not a helicopter.
Before you ask, yes, I am sure. I have only one question, Colonel Smythe.
Smythe knew when not to argue. He also knew he was lucky to be bringing someone up to the Dutchman with him.
What is that?
She looked down at her mud-smeared clothing and shoes.
"Will there be a change of clothes aboard the Flying Dutchman?"
Smythe opened his mouth to reply with typically dry humor, then hesitated.
"I actually do not know how the ship is provisioned," he admitted. "Colonel Bishop will see to that, I'm certain. The ship also has fabrication facilities," he added hopefully, with more hope than certainty.
Before the ship returned to Earth, Skippy had warned the fabricators were one of many systems that were wearing out due to lack of replacement parts. Nunnally grimaced, pushing himself painfully to his feet.
"Colonel Smythe, if you'll have me, I would like to go with you."
Smythe was astonished and uncharacteristically spoke before thinking.
"Are you daft, man?"
"I did not know what is at stake, sir," Nunnally explained.
"If your mission up there fails, everyone on Earth dies.
You're sure of that?"
"Dead certain.
I have a wife and two children."
Nunnally's eyes flicked to Grudzian briefly.
"I want them to live. It is simple as that."
Holding the pistol with his left hand and pointing it safely at the ground but ready for trouble, Smythe held out his right hand, and Nunnally shook it briefly.
"I could use a good SAS man up there," Smythe admitted.
"No hard feelings, sir?"
"Nunnally, aboard the Flying Dutchman we will be in a desperate fight for the survival of humanity. There will be no room or time for feelings."
Despite the pain radiating from his bruised kidneys, Nunnally smiled.
"Bloody good, Colonel. I wouldn't have it any other way."
"Oh, hell," Staff Sergeant Grudzian groaned. "Is this life or death for everyone?"
"More than you can imagine," Smythe nodded once, slowly.
Grudzian looked up to where the high-pitched whine of turbines was coming out of the thick clouds. He had a duty to his wife and child at home. He also had a duty to keep them alive and safe. And he couldn't do that dirt side while others went to the stars to fight. Holding out a hand, he asked,
"Can I borrow that special phone you have, Colonel? This is going to take a bit of explaining. My wife expects me back home in 3 days."
Skippy had contacted as many former pirates as he could. Most of them were already in what the authorities called protective custody and were not able to help. Others were hesitant to participate in what they viewed as a mutiny. One former pirate told Skippy he thought the world's governments may be right, that Earth could not continue trying to fight the entire galaxy with a single broken-down starship.
"I'm sorry," the man reluctantly told the beer can. "We did great things out there. I'm proud of my service with the pirates. But what we did ultimately attracted the attention of the Maxalts."
The only American former pirate he could contact who was willing and able to deploy immediately was one Navy pilot on a deep-sea fishing trip off the coast of Mobile, Alabama. Commander Jim Porter had been about to crack open his first beer of the morning when Skippy called him, and the appearance of a Theranan dropship was the highlight of the day for the charter boat's customers and crew. One of his fishing companions was an Air Force pilot who had come along partly to hear war stories from Porter.
"Sir," Lieutenant Alan Edwards said, with one eye on Porter and one on the dropship descending vertically over the fishing boat that was rocking side to side from the force of the dropship's belly jets.
"I want to go with you."
Porter turned, startled, and leaned toward the young pilot, cupping a hand over one ear. With the Falcon in hover and lowering a self-guiding cable, it was hard to hear over the whoosh of the turbines, the spray kicked up, and the fishing boat's diesels as the charter captain tried to keep his boat steady.
"What? Commander, I want to come with you."
Edwards emphasized his shouted words by pointing to himself, then the merry pirate, then gesturing toward the hovering Falcon.
"Do you know what you're getting yourself into?"
Porter shouted back, looking up to watch the cable as it steered toward him.
"No, sir,"
Edwards replied, holding out a hand to steady Porter's shoulder as the boat rocked.
"Neither do you."
Porter glanced away from the cable for a second. When Skippy had called on a regular cell phone, he told Porter the Flying Dutchman would likely be going out with a skeleton crew, barely enough to operate the ship. Another pilot would undoubtedly be useful.
"Edwards, you have the right attitude. Grab this cable."
The end of the cable blossomed as Edwards grasped it, the nanofibers reforming to wrap around his torso, both legs, and under his arms. Before he could think twice or give a thumbs up that he was ready, Edwards was lifted off the deck of the boat, the cable yanking him sideways to avoid crashing into the boat's cabin.
As he tried to relax and not instinctively fight that super high-tech alien cable that was pulling him up toward a woman leaning out of the dropship's ramp, Edwards felt a thrill of excitement and at least a tiny bit of self-doubt.
"I sure hope to hell I know what I'm doing," he muttered to himself and closed his eyes for a moment.
With Edwards and Porter aboard, the Falcon's ramp closed and the craft began climbing, gently at first, then standing on its tail while the three passengers strapped in as best they could, unable to reach the cockpit. Sims leaned toward Porter to whisper.
"Picking up strays, Commander?"
She pointed to Edwards with a thumb. Porter shrugged.
"Skippy told me we are thin on personnel and he's a pilot. If he doesn't work out, we can send him back down."
"I don't know about that."
Sims bit her lip, wishing Porter had cleared his action with her before offering to bring a new and unknown person aboard. It was too late to land the Falcon now. They were soaring over the Gulf of Mexico and—
"Wait!"
Sims slapped a hand on the armrest.
"Skippy, we have one more stop."
"You are kidding me, right?"
the beer can gasped.
"No, I am not. We need to land."
She fiddled with the map function of her phone. Even modified by Skippy, the brand new phone was painfully slow compared to a Z phone. She looked for a target close to the Falcon's projected flight path up to rendezvous with the Flying Dutchman. At that point, the starship was over the other side of the planet, so it might have been faster to fly over Australia than reverse course.
"Land again? I told you there isn't anyone else we can pick up," Skippy protested. "Not without a violent confrontation. We must proceed to the Flying Dutchman immediately."
"No, here. Land here."
Sims jabbed a finger at the map on her phone.
"Colonel Sims," the beer can complained. "We are taking a risk by landing again."
"You think the FBI is waiting for us at a public supermarket in Florida?"
"Ah, sarcasm. No, I doubt that."
"Then do it."
"Okay, fine. Do you want to hit the drive-thru for a McFlurry, too? Maybe land in front of a drugstore so you can stock up on cute nail polish."
"Skippy,"
Sims gritted her teeth as the Falcon heeled over in a tight turn.
"If I'm going to be stuck out there for years with a beer can and a ship full of monkeys, cute nail polish is a must-have. Don't argue with me."
The AI did not speak until the Falcon flared for landing.
"Make it quick, please. Your Air Force vectored a pair of F-35s toward us. They will be in weapons range in less than 10 minutes.
"I'll be back in 4 minutes.
Sims swallowed hard to control her queasy stomach and unstrapped, shielding her eyes from dust swirling in the open ramp kicked up by the belly jets.
Porter rose from his seat.
"I'll go with you," he offered,
but Sims shook her head, waving him back as she sprinted down the ramp.
"What the hell is she doing?"
Edwards asked, unstrapping from his seat and walking back to stand at the top of the ramp, watching the woman run and stumble across what appeared to be a construction site next to the shopping center. The ground had been cleared of trees and scraped mostly flat. Piles of sand and puddles of wet mud the color of black coffee dotted the land like landmines. She weaved around the mud, slipping, and Sims nearly fell, windmilling her arms. Then she was in the parking lot and dodging cars that had screeched to a halt, their drivers astonished at the sight of the big alien dropship plopped down in a muddy suburban field. Two cars had collided head-on, their driver still sitting behind the wheel, transfixed by the sight of the sleek airspace craft, its skids sunk halfway into the rain-drenched ground, steam rising from under its belly jets and twin turbines.
"She is the logistics officer," Porter speculated.
"Maybe there's some vital item we need."
"A vital item that's available at a Publix?"
Edwards shook his head in alarm as Porter opened a locker, pulling out a Krestang rifle.
"Sir, what are you doing with that?"
"In case some law-abiding citizen decides to perform his civic duty by getting in our way.
This can discourage any idiots," Porter explained, flipping off the safety and deselecting the explosive tips. All he wanted to do was get people's attention if needed. It was not needed. Less than a minute after entering the building, Sims came racing out carrying a cardboard box and tossing a handful of dollar bills on the sidewalk as she ran. When she got close to the ramp, Edwards looked quizzically at Porter, holding his hands palms up in a what-the-hell gesture, but the Navy pilot only shook his head with a sheepish grin. Sims pounded up the ramp, and the sleek machine was already lifting off as the three secured themselves in the seats. She struggled to tug a seatbelt strap around the cardboard box.
"Ma'am,"
Porter shouted over the screaming belly jets as the ramp was still closing.
"What did you get?"
Sims did not answer with words. With a wink and grin, she opened the box and pulled out a plastic jar of marshmallow fluff. Real fluff. Flipping the lid aside showed the box was full of jars, their red plastic lids lined up.
You are kidding me.
Porter's face fell. Sims shook her head, and she was no longer smiling.
The last time we left Earth, I brought a case of generic marshmallow cream aboard, and Colonel Bishop wanted to perform an exorcism against it. I had to toss the whole case out an airlock. It's still floating in orbit, for all I know. I am not making that mistake again this time.
Colonel Sims, shame on you, Skippy's voice broke in. I'm having to climb your Falcon straight up to avoid those F-35s, and you brought a box of processed sugar?
A box of pure deliciousness, according to our fearless leader.
That was still a foolish risk, the AI admonished.
Really? She arched an eyebrow. We may be gone a very long time trying to defeat the most powerful enemy in the galaxy. Do you want Colonel Bishop to be happy or cranky?
Good point. I guess that was excellent judgment. Hang on, everyone. Those F-35s just launched missiles at us. I've engaged stealth, but I don't want to enable point defense masers to avoid collateral damage below us, so I'm going to a full power climb.